This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Paul Stamets, founder of Fungi Perfecti, a family-owned, environmentally friendly company specializing in using gourmet and medicinal mushrooms to improve the health of the planet and its people. Paul is the 1998 recipient of the Collective Heritage Institute's Bioneers Award. A dedicated mycologist for over 30 years, he has written 6 books on mushroom cultivation use and identification, including his most recent book, Mycelium Running: How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. He also has authored numerous articles and scholarly papers on medicinal, culinary, and psychoactive mushrooms. Paul Stamets is here today to tell us about the use of mushrooms for myco-restoration. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
What led to your interest in mushrooms?
Well, my earliest memories by far was when I was 5 years old and my parents told me not to squeeze puffballs near my twin brother's face because they thought the spores could cause blindness. That's not true. But when you tell a young 5-year-old boy not to pelt his twin brother with puffballs, then I put that information readily to use and pelted him with as many puffballs as I could. So that's my first memory, you know, and I think mushrooms are enticing because they engage animals to help them disperse spores. And whether it's children puffing puffballs or birds or deer or bear, we're all involved in the spread of spores, and fungi engage us for that purpose.
Would you give a brief overview of the role that mushrooms play in our natural ecosystems?
Yes, I'd love to. This is a very interesting subject and has become increasingly more interesting of late. Scientific research has recently shown some rather remarkable properties in the history of evolution of fungi on this planet. We split from fungi about 650 million years ago. We are more closely related to fungi than we are to any other kingdom. And so our best antibiotics come from fungi because we share in common many of the same pathogens. And so we have very good antibacterial antibiotics that come from fungi, but we have very poor antifungal antibiotics because of our close ancestry with that kingdom of fungi. Those antifungal antibiotics also tend to be harmful to us. And of course, an antibiotic is not useful if it harms the host. So we share a deep ancestry with fungi, and fungi were the first organisms that came to land 1.3 billion years ago. And plants followed several hundred million years later. Now, fungi were able to come to land because they produce oxalic acid and a number of other acids. And these acids actually are 2 carbon dioxide molecules joined together. And they pull out minerals out of bedrock. And so oxalic acid will pull calcium out of rock and form calcium oxalates. And in doing so, it begins to crumble the rock. And so the vanguard organisms on land, on Earth, were first fungi. And then plants followed several hundred million years later. Now, there's a fantastic fossil that has been a big mystery for over 150 years. It's called Prototaxides. It was first discovered in 1859. It was thought to be a large ancestral tree, but 420 million years ago, the tallest plants on Earth were less than 2 feet tall. And this mystery was recently solved by Dr. Kevin Boyce, who published an article in the Journal of Geology, and he discovered that actually Prototaxides were giant fungi. Now, these were 30 feet tall. So this was the tallest organism on land 420 million years ago. The landscapes of Earth were dotted with giant mushrooms. Who knew? And so as we look at the field of fungi and what they do in nature, they're the grand molecular disassemblers and the soil magicians. They are actually munching up rocks, and they're creating the soil matrix and actually are the foundation of the food chain. And indeed, life on this planet is totally dependent upon the mycelial networks. And the mycelium is this fine cobwebby substance that everyone sees if you go out into the woods and tip over a log, or when you pick a mushroom, it's the root-like structure that grows underneath. And the mushrooms are the fruit of that root-like structure, which is called mycelium. And so when we find a mushroom in the forest, it's like the tip of the iceberg. We're finding something that may be dozens of acres in size, and it erupts into a single colony of mushrooms.
You are a proponent of myco-restoration. Would you explain what you mean by myco-restoration?
Micro-restoration has several components, and it's a word that I made up because it's an umbrella concept that covers micro-remediation, which is the use of fungi to break down toxic chemicals. It's a form of bioremediation. There are mycopesticides, which is using entomopathogenic fungi. These are fungi that kill insects, and you can use these to replace chemical pesticides. And the Environmental Protection Agency is very keen on promoting entomopathogenic fungi to replace chemical pesticides. There's mycofiltration, which is using mycelium as a filtration medium that captures bacteria and silt and other compounds and prevents downstream contamination. And there is the use of mycomedicines, and I believe habitats have immune systems just like people, and the diseases that proliferate in the ecosystem is oftentimes a reflection of the loss of biodiversity, including mycodiversity, the loss of fungi. So the soil matrix and the habitats that have given us birth are intertwined and held together by these mycelial matrices. And if we lose those, the ecosystems begin to unravel.
Looking specifically at mycoremediation, what properties of mushrooms make them good candidates for degrading or removing chemical toxins from the environment?
Well, most people know that oil comes from decomposing plants, and fungi break down plant and animal tissue. Moreover, plant tissue is largely composed of lignin and cellulose. And if you go into the woods and you see a brown checkered stump, that usually is predominantly lignin. And if you go and you see a stump that is pithy and white, that is usually cellulose. Well, when fungi break down trees, some fungi break down lignin better than cellulose and vice versa. And so every species of fungi has a unique cascades of enzymes that are customized to the ecological niche that they grow in. And so we can harness these enzyme suites from fungi, and because hydrocarbons and all petroleum products are held together by the same carbon-hydrogen bonds that hold lignin and cellulose together, many of these fungi are exquisitely well-designed for breaking down a wide spectrum of contaminants, including oil and dioxins and PCBs and pesticides, herbicides, etc. So they're very clever at being able to go into a landscape. And again, because of mycodiversity in an ecosystem, it is the plurality of fungal species in that ecosystem that give us candidates to be able to rise up to the occasion and gobble up the toxins that are harming the ecosystem. So I see these fungi as having an overview towards protecting the ecosystem from different forms of catastrophia, whether it's nature-borne, like hurricanes, tornadoes, floods. Fungi leap to the forefront, gobble up that newly available material. Similarly, if there's a toxic waste spill, through natural selection, those fungi that are equipped to break down those toxins also rise up. And so we have a fantastic resource here, particularly in the Northwest, because we have such a great fungal diversity, to be able to find different candidates that are very appropriate to breaking down some of these toxins or prevent other forms of pollution that are of concern.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Paul Stamets, founder of Fungi Perfecti and author of the book Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. Our topic is mycorestoration. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are some specific examples of mushrooms being successfully used in cleaning toxins from the environment?
Well, we've been involved in several research projects, and we were involved with a project outside of Bellingham, Washington, with Battelle Laboratories, and there was a diesel spill that was in a Department of Transportation yard where they had trucks and buses and other vehicles stored for many, many years, and the soil became saturated up to 2% with diesel products. And so the Department of Ecology actually told the Department of Transportation that they had a toxic waste issue that had to be cleaned up. There was encouragement to do experimental methods at bioremediation. So we were involved, and there was four piles. One was a control pile. One pile was treated with enzymes. One pile was treated with bacteria. And the fourth pile, we inoculated with oyster mushroom mycelium. Now, oyster mushrooms are very, very common in the Pacific Northwest. They grow on alder and cottonwood and maple trees, especially in the spring. And so I had previously known and had done other experiments using oyster mushroom mycelium to break down diesel. And we were engaged, and we did this experiment. And 6 to 7 weeks later, after we did our treatments, our group went up there, and the first pile, which is dead, dark, and stinking, and smelled like diesel, remained lifeless, basically. The second and third piles also did not have much activity. And the fourth pile, when the tarps were removed, our pile was covered with hundreds of pounds of oyster mushrooms. And the oyster mushroom mycelium produces these enzymes and acids, and it breaks the hydrogen-carbon bonds, and it then remanufactures those into fungal carbohydrates, into sugars. And so we proved that mushroom mycelium was very good at breaking down what's called PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, from 20,000 parts per million to less than 200 in a period of about 8 to 10 weeks. So that was a fantastic success story. More recently, the Costco Busan freighter hit the Bay Bridge on November, I think, 10th of last year and spilled 58,000 gallons of Bunker C oil, which is extremely crude, heavy oil that ships use for burning in their furnaces. And this oil spill created a massive amount of pollution in the Bay Area. A group that we were working with called MatterOfTrust.org, they employed human hair mats, and thousands of citizens immediately went out to the beaches before even the Coast Guard could respond. And human hair is exquisitely well designed for soaking up oil. And so the oil was soaked up, and then the Presidio gave us a space right beside the Golden Gate Bridge, and we did a series of experiments there in inoculating the human hair-soaked oil mats with oyster mushroom mycelium. We just received the results back about 2 weeks ago, and we had also very, very good success in breaking down the oil contaminants into a very low toxin form. So bioremediation using fungi has really picked up speed, and it's now going on in several places of the world. In this area, we're now involved in mycofiltration, in using mushroom mycelium to capture coliform bacteria that flows into the Puget Sound. And I have a very cool invention of using burlap sacks that are filled with wood chips and mushroom mycelium. And these burlap sacks are placed into waterways or where there's storm runoff, and they infiltrate with the coliform-rich and petroleum-rich water, and in doing so, capture those contaminants and break them down. And we have several projects here in Mason County that are showing very promising results.
What steps do you think are needed for more widespread application of mushrooms in cleansing toxins from the environment?
Well, public education is very important because, unfortunately, there's a biological prejudice against mushrooms, and it's a form of racism, actually, because when you mention mushrooms, then immediately people think magic mushrooms or portobello mushrooms. They make a bad joke, and it's hard to get past that hurdle. And if people knew that mushroom mycelium, actually the largest organism in the world, is a mycelial mat in eastern Oregon, over 2,200 acres in size, it's only one cell wall thick. Now, that's quite remarkable because we have five or six cell walls that protect us from infection, and yet the mycelium can grow to thousands of acres in size and be the largest organism in the world and be only one cell wall thick. How does it do that? It does that because it's in constant biomolecular communication with its ecosystem. And these are intelligent mycelial networks of cells that respond in very diverse ways. And so what I see is an important need. For a few thousand dollars, we can save millions of dollars. And what I mean by that, by a few thousand dollars and using burlap sacks filled with wood chips coming from storms, and we can be guaranteed that we have storms every year, using the very chips that the road crews are chipping those down branches that are fouling the power lines, using those wood chips inoculated with oyster mushroom mycelium, for instance, filling it into burlap sacks, only costs a few hundred or a few thousand dollars, and it may open up the shellfish industry, increasing tax revenue, tourist dollars, keeping people off unemployment. These type of eco-friendly strategies, I think, can go a long way in creating new best management practices that can be employed around the Puget Sound. And some of the hurdles that we face is, other people didn't think of this first, so they feel challenged by a new idea. Again, you have this sort of mycophobia, this irrational fear of fungi, and so we have to overcome this sort of biological prejudice and getting people to understand that, oyster mushrooms are the most common mushroom in valleys of the Puget Sound. This is part of the healthy ecosystem, and these are natural allies. And when we start using that which nature has already recommended, I think we can go a long ways in cleaning up a lot of the pollution that is otherwise fouling our saltwater estuaries and the salmon habitats and the shellfish industry, as well as recreation. So the more that we can do to help clean up the Puget Sound, I think the better it is for our economy, and it's ecologically intelligent to do so.
How receptive do you find the organizations in our area to your ideas?
Actually, my best advocates have been my skeptics, and when they are convinced and see the data and see how user-friendly this is, they do a 180-degree turnaround. And I'm happy to say that's true with the Mason County Health Department and the Mason County Public Works Department and the Mason County Conservation District here that I'm working with. When we try to go up the chain of command to other organizations who are the gatekeepers, you know, they give us some resistance. But the data speaks for itself. And right now we have several experiments, and one experiment is showing the coliform bacteria going from 900 colonies per 100 milliliters of water down to around 50 in a space of around 10 feet. And so this is using these mycopods, which is the burlap sacks that are infused with mushroom mycelium. And so this is something that we're trying to advance. And, you know, we're a very small company. I've done this all basically at no charge and at considerable expense. And I'm dedicated to this, so I have no problems with that. But in order for us to have a threshold of mass that is sufficient to have a positive effect on the salmon runs and the shellfish industry, I think we need to do this widespread. And that is the difficulty that we face right now.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Paul Stamets, founder of Fungi Perfecti and author of the book Mycelium Running: How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. Our topic is mycorestoration. What led to your realization that mushrooms could be used as pesticides?
I lived in a house that was built in 1910. I had a flat roof in Washington State, go figure. And there was an enormous number of leaks. In fact, when we finally tore down the house, we found there was more than a dozen buckets that were catching leaks that we didn't even know about. And so the house, when it became saturated with water, you know, it would then invite fungi, and mycelium, as it rots wood, invites insects. And so carpenter ants were destroying my house. And most people should know that termites and ants like wood that has mycelium on it because it makes it sweeter and it's a lot more tender. And so the carpenter ants were munching down my house, and every morning I'd be vacuuming up one spot in particular where there would be a little sawdust pile. My mother trained me well. I'm very good at vacuuming and washing dishes. I do a lot of that, it seems. And so as I drink my coffee, I'd be vacuuming up part of my house. And so I went to the EPA.gov homepage of the Environmental Protection Agency and found a group of fungi that they were keen on promoting because they did not hurt bees, they did not hurt beneficial insects, but they were uniquely positioned at infecting termites and carpenter ants. And so I ordered some of these fungi, and through a process, it's a great scientific adventure story, I was able to come up with a series of new ideas, and I have several patents now that have been issued that could totally replace chemical pesticides throughout the world using fungi in their pre-sporulating form. And the mycelium is attractive to the insects, whereas the spores will kill the insects. The insects aren't stupid. They avoid the spore state. But I discovered that if you delayed sporulation and you grew basically white, fuzzy mycelium before the green spores form, then the insects actually would pick up the mycelium and give it to the queen. And since these are social insects, if you can control or kill the queen, then you can get rid of the entire colony. Moreover, after the colony is killed, then it does sporulate, but these are not house syndrome fungi. But the spore repellency factor is so strong that it prevents future invasion of the insects back into your house. So my first patent issued in 2003, and about a year ago, I received my second patent against all social insects, around 200,000 species. The Australian Patent Office just issued me a new patent, which basically is all entomopathogenic fungi, fungi that kill insects, prior to sporulation, has been approved against all insects. So now I have the entire kingdom. Now, these are really, really powerful patents, and I realize that they come with great responsibility. We wage no war against insects. You know, I just don't want to have termites or carpenter ants in my house. And so I have very strong guiding principles about how these patents can be licensed, and that indeed has caused some problems in getting this commercialized. So we're diligently moving forward. But this is easier to grow than a mushroom kit, and it literally, you know, can save one's greatest investment in life, their house, with an environmentally benign method. And it's very inexpensive to produce. And once the ants or termites are killed, then they don't reinvade your house because of sporulation and the avoidance of the spores by the insects.
What do you see as the challenges to using this approach in a more widespread way?
Well, the chemical pesticide industry is not keen on this type of green technology. We went to every major chemical pesticide company or player in that space in the past 3 years, and they're a service industry. 95% of their revenue is for these trucks to come to your house, put down bait stations, you know, look for hits where the insects actually go into these little bait stations around your house, and then they'll write up a treatment procedure, and then usually using chemical type of pesticides, tenting your house, even heating it, and that will cost you many thousands of dollars, and it doesn't really work that well because a few years later, the insects reinvade. So we have a solution that literally for under $100 per house could put them out of business. And as we were told by several high executives in these industries, this is terrible. We'd have to lay off most of our employees. I was shocked to hear that. I thought this is for the greater good. This would be highly marketable. It's mail order friendly. But no, they had built an entire industry based on the petrochemical industry, and most of these chemical pesticides are coming from the oil industry. And they have billion-dollar profit wheels that have been proven over many, many years, and they're not ready to disassemble them for something that is so green, of which I've invented. So we're meeting a lot of resistance. And so we're going now through the registration process of the EPA to try to do this all on our own. But, Diane, I'm trying to save the world. I'm only one person. There's a lot, not enough hours in a day for all the work that needs to be done.
Could you just very briefly touch also on how mushrooms can be used in forest restoration following logging?
Yeah, well, most people who've been to an old-growth forest and they come back after it's been clear-cut, I mean, there's a dramatic contrast. And I actually worked up in Darrington, Washington for several logging companies, and I was involved in cutting down the old-growth forest. And as we say, we're sitting in the brush between turns, and as the logs go up the valley, you know, I was just amazed at several things. One, massive dehydration, increase in temperature as soon as the trees are cut, and there's tons of carbon per acre being exported. And I was thinking to myself, where's all this carbon coming from? Well, you know, it's coming from the fungi, you know, as it creates soils. And so the carbon bank, the soil bank, as it becomes thicker, actually gathers carbon dioxide and binds it into the soil. Most people don't realize this because they think fungi are producing CO2. Well, they are, but about half of that CO2 is bound up within the soil. And so as soils become thicker, there's more carbon dioxide that is being sequestered. And when I'm sitting in the brush looking at all these trees and stumps and the huge amount of carbon that is being taken away, I'm thinking to myself, this is rapidly becoming a process of diminishing returns. Around 1900 or so, when the first European settlers came in this area and logged massively, those trees were created basically after the last ice age, 10,000 years ago. And so you cut down the old-growth forest, and then it naturally receded. In the 1940s and 50s, they cut down the second growth, you know, same story. And then in the year 2000, they cut down the third growth. Well, there's six insults upon the carbon bank. And the reason why there's six is they first cut the trees, that's one, then they burn, that's two. And so all the carbon's vaporized and going into the atmosphere. And in the 1950s, same thing happens, three and four. In the year 2000, you know, five and six. And so I'm definitely not an advocate of burning, especially because it ends up robbing the carbon bank. So now we have premature decline. We have trees toppling over at 30 years because the soils become so thin, the root wads can't hold the trees up. So I see a new form of forestry called mycoforestry, where you do selective logging and you infuse chainsaws with biodegradable oils that have mushroom spores in them. And so as the brush is being cut, the open faces of that brush immediately become inoculated with fungi. And in doing so, that wood then is becomes saprophytized and it returns the carbon back into the soil. Otherwise, the brush is in the air and it becomes ashen gray and dries out and it's locked out of the carbon cycle. And many of us have seen this, these ashen gray stumps and whatnot that are baking in the sun and extremely flammable, and they're not decomposing. And so speeding up the decomposition cycles will speed up the sequestration of carbon into the soil bank, thickening the soils, and lead to habitat recovery.
Well, we're out of time, but what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, you know, I think we have a fungally fantastic ecosystem here in the Northwest, and fungi can be our allies. And they have a lot of properties heretofore undiscovered that are being discovered now that are extremely important for ecological and human health. And I would encourage anyone listening to go out into the woods and collect mushrooms. And it brings people back in direct contact with nature. It's a great thing for families to do. And it carries on an age-old tradition of being able to understand the invisible landscape upon which we walk.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Paul.
Thank you, Diane.
We have just been speaking with Paul Stamets, founder of Fungi Perfecti and author of the book Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. For more information, check on the web at www.fungi.com. Again, that's FUNGI.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.